accession number 20886, Reel 2.
Captain Bryson, Reel 2. I was just asking you about how nervous you felt going to sea in a tanker.
Well, I never thought of it a lot then. As I say, we'd been on our own a lot of the time. We weren't in convoys so much. I think I felt more nervous when we were in convoy than I did when we were on our own. And yet, I suppose I shouldn't have done, because there was quite a few ships attacked in the Pacific, and we heard the SOSs and that. So, and the Bloemfontein, a big Dutchman, was one of them. I can remember that name. But I think it was more, I was more nervous when we were actually in convoy. You sort of realised then there was a war on. But
were there any precautions in the tanker in case of attack?
Not really. We all had our lifeboat stations. The lifeboats were always swung out. The lifeboats were always swung out and bowsed into the ship's side, so that you didn't have to lift them and that. But that was the only precautions, really, I'd say. We had a couple of rafts aboard the ship, but they were only wooden rafts. But there was no other precaution. We used to have the usual fire drills and boat drills, but they were the same in peacetime, really, as they were in wartime. You had to have them, border trade sport, as you called it, once a week.
What kind of a chance would you have stood if you had been hit by the enemy?
Well, on that ship, on the Ethel Viking, I don't think it was so bad, because we had mainly crude oil and naval fuel oil that we were carrying. There's not a lot of gas given off by that. And the odd ship did blow up. It was unlucky with the fuel oil. But it was mainly clean oil tankers, gasoline and petrol tankers that were, you know, the real danger ones, I think. And of course, the Germans were always after the tankers, because that was the idea to stop the army getting it and that, and the navy ships. Anyway, as I say, we joined.
But can I just also ask you what the Ethel line was to work for during the war? Was it a good employer or not?
Well, yes, they were a good employer. They were good, yes. I couldn't say much against, except, of course, that they didn't relieve me after 2 years, the same as they relieved all the rest of the crew. They just left me on the ship because, as I say, I was signed on to the company and not to the ship. But I think that was the only thing that they really let me down on. Well, they were quite good employers. We didn't get an awful lot of money. We got £10 for the first year, £12 for the second year, £18 for the third year, and £20 for the fourth year. That was your 4 years indentures. And that was for the year, £60 for 4 years. But then they brought in that we they could give apprentices half the war bonus that the rest of the crew got. And so the war bonus originally was, I think, £7. And so we used to get £3.10 a month war bonus, which, of course, to me, was a lot of money in the wartime.
What were living conditions like in the ship?
Oh, they were quite good. The apprentices' accommodation was very good. We had our own rooms, our own alleyway, and the master's stairs, companionway, went up off our alleyway. But it was very good. We kept it clean ourselves. Well, when I was there on my own, I kept it clean on my own. and there was generally only me that used it. So we used to have inspections every week. But no, it was quite good, really. Had no complaints about the accommodation. We didn't have running water or anything like that. We had a compact which you used to pull down and pour your water in from a bucket, and you used to get washed and with a bucket of water. And then you lifted the bowl up, lifted the compact up, and the water ran down and into a sort of can at the bottom. And then you had to empty the can when it got full, of course, over the side. Bathroom, we had our own bathroom, but no, again, the only running water was salt water in the bathroom. You had no hot water, no cold water in the bathroom either, but you used to have a board across and you used to put a bucket in, and that was how you had a bath, was out of a bucket. And you used to get two buckets of water, one to wash in and then the other one to swill yourself down after. And to get water, we had to, there was no tanks midships, and we had to go aft to the galley. Well, there was an unwritten rule that if you took hot water out of the galley boiler, you had to put two buckets back. And the pump was just outside the galley. It was an ordinary hand pump. And you used to fill the buckets and put the water in first, and then the cook would allow you to take one bucket of hot water out for it. And that's the way it used to work. And then you used to have to carry it along the flying bridge from aft to midships, and in bad weather it was quite a job. You lost more than you got to the other end with.
How were apprentices treated aboard ship?
Well, they were supposed to teach you, but give you lessons and that sort of thing, and give you tuition. But during the war, they never did. It was up to you what you wanted to do. And you had your books, and you used to... I used to study at night with my books and that. And listen to the radio. That was the one thing you could have, was at sea, was a radio. And of course, going on the American run for that, you had the radio on all the time while I was working at night and reading Nichols' Seamanship and Nichols' Concise Guide and all these books that were then in vogue. And but the officers, they didn't teach you anything. They were too involved with themselves. I suppose they were a bit older, and maybe they were more knowledgeable about what could happen than I was. So maybe that's why.
What would you listen to on wireless?
Well, music programs, nearly all the time. And my knowledge of the popular music in during the war, 1942, 1943, 1944, well, I can sing every one, I think, that they start with. I went to Battle of the Atlantic 1993. They had a concert in the St. George's Hall. They had a Canadian band and then a British band, and they played all these songs that I used to sing. It was all water, and I was joining in every one of them. And a woman in front turned round and said, "By Jove, you know all the songs." Because that's what I used to do. That's the only thing you could do. I was the only apprentice, and you didn't mix with the crew, and the officers you didn't mix with. We weren't allowed to eat in the saloon. The only time we had in the saloon was when it was Christmas Day. And then you got into the saloon with the rest of the officers. But, so you were pretty much a... It was very lonely, a very lonely life, I'll say that.
Was it an unhappy time for you?
No, I don't think so, because I'm quite happy with my own company. I can. When you get master of a ship, it's exactly the same. You start at the bottom as an apprentice, and you're lonely. But when you get master of a ship, loneliness is just the same, because nobody comes to see you, hardly. The only time they come to see you is when there's something wrong, or they want advice or anything. You go onto the bridge, and they all, yes, sir, you know, and all this. And you go down, and that's it. You don't mix an awful lot. Or you didn't in those days. Well, even when I say those days, up to 20 years ago.
What kind of reception would you get in the different ports around the world in the wartime?
Oh, well, very good. New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand was excellent. Auckland was good. They had the Seaman's Mission in San Pedro, and they used to entertain you there. We also, Gracie Fields was over there, and there was a couple of us invited out to a meal with Gracie Fields and her husband, an Italian. And we went to different shows. They used to have Bundles for Britain shows. And I met quite a lot of film stars when we were running to San Pedro through this.
What was this Bundles for Britain?
Well, they used to have dinners and that, where they paid all the stars and that paid $400 or $500, and all the money bought clothes and food, which they used to send across to Britain. At the mission in San Pedro, they used to give us concerts. We had Joan Blondell there one time. What was it? The South American Don Amici. He was there. He came and it was different ones. Oh, very good, excellent.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with your going to Hull to join Empire Flint.
Yes, I went across to Hull then. I was sent across to Hull without any leave. And joined the Empire Flint at Salt End Jetty. And
was this a tanker?
Tanker. And this was a clean oil tanker, or petrol. Because she was built during the war and she was new and she'd been on clean oil, as they call it, all the time. So I joined her, and we went across to New York. And there, we got fitted out to go to Russia. And we had insulation was put in between the bulkhead and the actual wooden partition of the cabin. And they filled the forepeak full of cement for the ice, going through the ice. And that, and they did different things. And then we went down from New York, we went down to near Philadelphia, a port, little port, on the river for Philadelphia. And we loaded 100 octane aviation spirit, and then from there we went back to New York. And New York we came across in a convoy to Glasgow. We arrived in Glasgow towards the end of the January, and we waited for the convoy to form up in Loch Long, and then from Loch Long we all sailed, all the ships in the convoy. There was about 30 ships, I think it was, something like that, in the convoy. And when we got outside, and the next morning we could see the escort, and The only escort we had was one old W-class destroyer and two corvettes and a fishing boat, which we weren't very happy about. We thought that was the escort up. Or put it this way, I did, because on the bridge the captain probably knew it was not, and that, but of course they don't tell you things like that. And then when we got a bit further up, the what they call the ocean escort joined us, and they all sailed down the middle of the convoy, and it was two aircraft carriers, a cruiser, the Bologna, about 14, 15 destroyers, and then about 8 corvettes. Well, they formed round the convoy, and the destroyers and that, the main body of the escort, they go out clear of the convoy, and you can't see them. Now, in the middle was the two aircraft carriers, and they were in the middle of the convoy. Now, we were in about the third lane in, being a tanker. They put the tankers inside as well, so as that the submarines, if they're going to fire torpedoes, you've got a bit of chance of them hitting the other ship before you get hit. But the day that the escort joined, we sighted the first German plane, or the German plane sighted us, whichever way you want to put it. And from then on, between the hours of daylight, it used to come daylight about 11:30, and it'd go dark. It was only a sort of semi-daylight, and 2 o'clock. And during that period, that was the time that the planes came and attacked us all the time. But there was another apprentice with me on that ship, and our job was, when we turned to in the morning, was we'd have a 5-gallon drum of Killfrost, and he used to put this on all the working parts of the ship. Now, the tanker was a steam tanker, a steamship, and of course the windlasses were steam, the windlasses aft was steam, so you, even in the cold weather where the temperature was 50 degrees below, you had to keep these going, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to tie up or anything. And so our job, first thing, we knew it right away, we didn't have to be told by the mate, was we got up and got this Killfrost, and one had a hammer and the other had a round paintbrush, and you went to the lifeboats, and where the spindles were, one would hit it with the hammer and all the ice would fall off, and quickly the other one slapped more grease all over Killfrost. And this is what you did with the windlass and the windlass aft, the winch aft, the docking winch. All these working parts had to be done with Killfrost, and that was our main job, really, going up there. We did that. You did that more or less in the dark, because it still turned to at 7 o'clock in the morning, even though it was dark. Worked. And then when the planes came, of course, I was on an all. When the attacks came, and the alarm went, I was on an Oerlikon gun, on the Monkey Island. I used to dash up Monkey Island and get behind this Oerlikon. And once the all clear was gone, the planes had gone back again to normal duties, putting this Killfrost on. You had to get it on as quick as you could. As soon as he knocked it, all the ice came off, and the ice built up to 3 and 4 inches thick. And when you hit it, of course, it, with the grease underneath, it all just fell off, and you coated it again. We had a second mate. I don't know whether you know, but during the war, young merchant seamen, and he had old, elderly merchant seamen. The reason was that all the third mates and second mates and mates out of the liner companies were taken into the R&R and put on naval ships as the navigators, because they were used to the navigating part. But nearly every ship in the Royal Navy had a merchant naval officer as a navigator. And of course that was a big drain. And so there was no young ones. And this second mate we had was a chap of 64. And he was as deaf as a door. And our first job, when the alarm bells went, which was pretty often, because of submarines as well, and our first job was to go and get him out, because he didn't hear the alarm bell, and it was right on his bulkhead, and he didn't hear it, because he was deaf. But that's what you say. When the third mate we went up there with was more or less a senior apprentice. He didn't have a certificate at all. He was a third mate without a certificate. And this was the way you worked during the war. Well, you didn't have the... people didn't have the qualifications, mainly because the Navy had taken them all up at the R&R.
Did the lack of qualifications in practice cause much disadvantage?
I don't think so, no. The third mate without a ticket, he'd served his time, 4 years as a apprentice cadet, so he knew what was going on the bridge and everything. So no, I don't think it affected the running of the ship or that. Generally the master was a chap of about 50 or that, and maybe older. And the mate, you'd get a mate of about 45. But it was the younger ones that the Navy took. Now, of course, there's been no need to take them because they haven't got enough naval ships to man themselves. But and there was that during the war. There was a lot of young people in the Merchant Navy, or they were older ones. Anyway, we got up to Russia all right. We only lost one ship, and that was the Bluebell Corvette. She was lost, but they didn't lose any of the merchant ships.
Did you see the Bluebell go down?
No, I didn't actually see her go down. But she was the only one that we lost. And then we went up to a place called Molotovsk. Well, the convoy split. Part went into Murmansk, and we went up to Molotovsk, which is in the White Sea, about 30 miles east and west of Archangel, southwest of Archangel. It's now the main Russian submarine base, Severodvinsk, I think it's called now. But then it was called Molotovsk, named after the Russian foreign minister, of course. But we didn't tie up there. We just, the icebreakers, we had three icebreakers when we were going through the White Sea. The ice was about 6 feet thick. And we had three icebreakers, the Lenin, the Stalin, and an American one, the North Wind, which the Americans had lent to the Russians. So we had the three icebreakers, and the Stalin used to lead the convoy through, and then we'd all keep close up behind, and if anybody got stuck, the Lenin or the Stalin or the North Wind would come and free the ship and take the ship back into the main body of the convoy. But the thing was that we used to stop at daylight at night we used to stop. And so, of course, it was mainly stopped there. We were only doing steaming about 5 hours in a day. And it's surprising the way you seem to go back. You'd make, say, in the 5 hours you're going, you might make 25 miles. But then the next morning, you'd have drifted back 5 miles with the ice moving. And so, of course, took us about 4 or 5 days to get up to Molotovsk to get in. And when you went in alongside, Molotovsk was nothing then. There was only wooden huts there. And when you got alongside, the icebreaker took you in and to alongside the jetty, and you just tied, and you put one, the icebreaker just left you, and you just froze in there. And you just put one rope out ahead from the bow and one rope astern. And these were just doing nothing really, but it held you alongside. If a wind had come, I suppose, or if the ice had really moved, you'd have got to something to hold. But we were just frozen in there the whole time. It took us about 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 4 weeks to discharge, because we used to discharge the alkalite, or aviation spirit, as it was, into tanker trucks, railway tankers, the small trucks that used to hold about 15 or 20 ton. And of course, with the pump on the ship, and all they had was an open hose into the top of this, and you'd fill about 3 tankers, and then they'd have to move the train, and you'd have to start again. And they'd just shout, when they got the hose in the top of the opening of the tank, they'd just shout, "Start la pumpa!" And then 30 seconds later, or a minute later, the outside, "Stop for la pumpa!" because the tank was full. And you had to have somebody on the controls of the pump all the time. And we discharged the whole 10,000 ton like that. And before we discharged, when we first started discharging, we tried to pump to suck into this, the pumps for to suck, but they couldn't, because the water, there's bound to be some water left in the tanks, because you'd wash them out, you'd clean them out and everything, and of course the oil on top and the water was at the bottom. The lowest place in the tank, of course, was your suction. And when we came to discharge, we tried to suck it out, and we couldn't. It was just a vacuum on the pump. And so what we had to do was fill the pipeline with salt water and pump it back into the tank to break the ice. And of course, the water all stayed at the bottom, and you then pumped that lot over the side once you'd got it free to break the ice around the suction of the pump. You pumped the first lot over the side to get rid of all the water. And then once the oil, the aviation spirit, petrol, came out, you started then pumping into the tanks. Well, that was the only way we could do it, because it was so cold that the drop of water that was around the suction had frozen up solid. And then we finished discharging. Oh, we went ashore in Murmansk, and we used to have the Inter-East Club, which you could go to. And
which club?
Inter-East, they called it. It was, they still have them up there now. It's a place where seamen could go. And they used to have Russian girls there that could dance. And what they wanted to do was try to teach you Russian.